Hey, everybody. Welcome to Peck Underground Church. I am your host, Josh Peck, and I am excited to be talking to you today. I see we already got a couple people in the live chat. That's great to see. And hey, listen, just a quick announcement. We got some, we have some pretty amazing guests coming up. Tomorrow is Ryan Peterson, and he wrote the book, Judgment of the Nephilim. That's tomorrow. And then we also have some exciting guests in the weeks to come. So make sure that you stay tuned for that. I'm very excited about tonight's guest. And I know we're starting a little early. Early, but believe it or not, this never happens. It was a miracle, and I just had to follow God on it. But I surprisingly was able to finish everything that I had to get done before 8 o'clock tonight. It never happens. Usually I'm late, if anything. So we had to jump on that opportunity. But I'd love to welcome my special guest who wrote the book, Game of Gods, Carl Tykrib. How are you doing, my friend?
Hey, I'm doing good. It's good to hear your voice and to be a part of your program this evening.
Well, I'm glad you were able to make time to do this. I know you stay busy. I stay busy. So, you know, this was great. But the book is phenomenal. And I've been hearing about this book for, I think, about 3 years now. When I first heard about it, we were speaking. I can't believe it's already been 3 years since this happened. But we were both speaking at a conference in Colorado. And right. You gave me the introduction to it. You had written the introduction. You gave it to me. I read it. I thought it was fantastic. I couldn't wait for the rest. And now I have the rest. So thank you for sending that along. For people who might not be familiar with you, your testimony, and what this book is all about, introduce yourself.
Okay. Wow. I'll begin at the beginning. No, I won't.
I was born and
yes, at a very young age. You know, Josh, I've been doing this kind of work, the aspect of researching and wrestling and trying to understand global transformation, really since the early 1990s. And I grew up on a grain farm. I live in the Canadian prairies. I could never have foreseen myself doing what I'm doing today if you would have asked me 30 years ago. And back in the early 1990s, I was working for a senior citizens healthcare program. It was a community-run program to help elderly people stay in their homes with private assistance and social programming. And my board of directors, wonderful people, were mostly made up of members of the Eastern Star, Freemasonry, or one of the other affiliated lodges in our community. And back then, I was asked to join the lodge. And you know, Josh, I never did join Freemasonry. I wasn't interested in more meetings. I had meetings coming out the wazoo already. And so I wasn't interested, flat out. And I didn't know anything about the lodge. I mean, this is early 1990s. And finally, a couple of my board members took me out for a supper meeting. And I related this in other areas, and they were grilling me why I wasn't joining the lodge. And I would ask them, are you about politics? No, we're not about politics. Are you about religion? No, we're not about religion. And we had already gone through all of this at one point or another, probably a couple of times. And so what are you guys about? We're about making good men better. Well, so what? Whip-de-doo. I mean, right. Really? And that presupposes I'm good to begin with? But let me tell you, I wasn't buying it. I just wasn't buying it. And so finally, one of them said to me, Carl, we are not Satanists. I'm like, where did that come from?
Were you already a Christian at this time?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I was wondering, where did this come from? Why would you say something like that? What prompted you? I mean, Josh, the warning bells are going off in the back of my mind. And it was a cacophony of warning bells. Just like, where did this come from? I mean, can you imagine you're trying to sell me, let's say you're a car salesman. I'm not interested in your product. And you think you're going to cinch the deal by saying we're not Satanists. That just doesn't work. And so, you know, I didn't know there were books written about the subject, and there weren't many at the time. I didn't know that there were people who were speaking out on Freemasonry. I didn't know any of that. This is before the time, probably about a year or two, three years before the age of the internet really coming out into the public. And so I just did what I felt right, and I went looking for their own works of philosophy and history and their monitors, and I worked to unpack it myself. And from that point on, by the mid-1990s, I had already traveled a dozen different rabbit trails, because that's where those studies take you. down all kinds of rabbit trails to try to understand, all right, how does the world work? And the two things that really struck me with Freemasonry that were problems for Christians, one was religious universalism, that we're all going to bend our knee to the same God around the same altar. It doesn't matter if you call him Allah or if what you call him, Krishna or Yahweh, it doesn't matter. And then the other one was perfectibility, that we're going to perfect ourselves through the work of the lodge, through the rituals of the lodge. And those are two things that really just glaringly stuck out, why, as a Christian, I couldn't even consider being a part of the lodge. But I was diving into the political elements by the mid-1990s, into social elements, into the Green Movement. And by 1997, I was asked to help an author in the U.S., Gary Kaw, write his book, The New World Religion. And from that point on, this is what I've been doing. I've been doing this full time, helping other authors, helping other lecturers and researchers to do the boots on the ground research, give them the information, give them the data, and help them pull things together. And along the way, and I have no formal training. Here's the thing, Josh. I have no formal training in any of this, okay? I'm just a farm boy, all right? And but that's who God uses, you know, regular people, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so I did the only thing I knew how to do, and I figured, well, you go to where these events are happening. You go to where these to where the world visionaries are setting the stage. You go where the agendas are being discussed. And so from 1997 on, I've been boots on the ground, probably 35, 40, maybe a little bit more, different types of organizations and events and forums and meetings, embedding myself with different organizations. And so along the way, I've gone to the United Nations. I was a part of a couple of different UN events. I've been involved in a number of global governance and world federalist events, major interfaith events like the, it just came back from the Parliament of World Religions in November, cultural events like Burning Man, the list goes on, pagan gatherings. And so I guess my specialty is I'm kind of an accidental researcher, and I go in places that nobody else has gone or even has really considered going. And primarily because that was the only way I could kind of figure out, all right, how do you get as close to the source in terms of the information as possible? My job has been to disseminate that, analyze it, and now communicate it.
That's fantastic. And so for those who are wondering, what can they expect from Game of Gods? And if they want to pick it up, if they're already sold and they want to get this book right now, where can they go? What's the easiest place?
Oh, definitely Amazon. Amazon Prophecy Watchers is also carrying it right now, too. So there's another venue that way. I have a website, gameofgods.ca. You can order it through that. But as soon as you click the link to order it, it goes straight to Amazon. And that is definitely the easiest way to do it. What can they expect? Well, they can expect 1,800 footnotes. Exactly, 1,800 footnotes. That's the one thing I did, Josh, is I overkilled on the documentation. And as people go through the documentation, and I hope they do, even if they don't read it all, it doesn't matter. Go through it, look at it, glance at it. I think they're going to realize that the documentation is pretty tight. It's pretty solid. I've done a lot of, golly, I've done two and a half decades now of pulling that documentation together. And so the documentation is really important. And you know, without that solid documentation, I wouldn't have felt comfortable tackling the topics that I did.
Fantastic. And so there was a couple of things you mentioned, and I'm curious about this. Your research into secret societies such as Freemasonry, do you see similarities between those types of organizations and then others that you've visited, like the UN and more out in the open established thing? Before you answer that, I want to give a special thank you to Thrivolous Z, who generously donated $30 through Super Chat. And he said, money for beer and wings with Carl. So we'll see how that goes. But I want to thank you so much, Thrivolous Z, for your contribution. And that's awesome. If people want to use the Super Chat function, you go right ahead. And we'll get to your question as soon as we can. So, but that is awesome. So, secret societies such as Freemasonry and things like that. Do you see a similarity between that or common threads and then others that are more out in the open, such as the UN or even things in the technocracy movement or even like Burning Man, things like that?
Yeah, you know, and it took me a while in as I wrestled through all these what seemed to be divergent movements, divergent themes. It took me a while to wrestle through and kind of come down to commonalities. And this is going to sound really basic, Josh, and it is really basic. But, you know, it's the basics that matter.
Because that's
right. it's from that foundation that we can build on other things. And so the bottom line was I found that there was three elements in play or three main themes in play between all of this. Mm-hmm. First, it's our desire to be as God. It's our desire to be like God. It's our desire to have that divine ascension, to be masters. And this is the second part, to be masters of meaning and destiny. We're the ones that determine meaning and destiny. And then third, what's the point of all of the above? What's the point of being as God? What's the point of determining our meaning and destiny? Well, it's simple. It's building heaven on earth. We're going to construct it in our image, in our vision, in the power we find in our unity. And that really is the commonality all the way through. Ironically, I didn't really pull that together or didn't really communicate it or verbalize it until the very last page of my book was done. And I was wrestling with, all right, how do I encapsulate in one sentence what the book is about and really what all these divergent points are about, what all these seemingly sometimes conflicting ideologies and conflicting movements, because sometimes they are conflicting. They are at war with each other. Right. And because I wanted to be able to put things right down to a bullet point. And that's hard to do with 570 pages, is make a single bullet point. And I, you know, this wasn't me. I didn't come up with this. I was driving home from church literally the day before we hit the send button to Amazon. And this thought hit me. And I believe it was the Spirit that prompted it. And it's basically this, and just what I shared with you. Humanity has three great desires: to be as God, to be masters of meaning and destiny, to build heaven on earth. And that is this story.
Mm. You talked about oneness, and this is something that I've wondered about too, because a lot of these people, they'll preach oneness, but then when you get in the upper levels, like in the elite, they seem to preach this oneness message, but it seems like they think that they're superior to everybody else and we're just kind of down here. So how would the oneness message fit with that? Or is it all just a big lie? And do the people at top not really believe that? How would they parse something like that out?
You know, that's a good question, because I've seen and heard from people like, oh golly, people involved at the United Nations talking about oneness, people who have substantial clout talking about oneness. And they believe it. They do believe it. It is definitely a worldview that they gravitate to. And for the most part, what I have seen is this, a belief that they are holding that this is for the betterment of everybody. And that's definitely a side of it where there's, you could say it's, I'm trying to think of the right word. There's good intentions. They're couching it in good intentions. And then I've also seen and heard of it, and I have it as well with the documentation, where humanity is the problem, where the excess population is the problem. And you know, Bertrand Russell had made some fantastic, utterly devastatingly fantastic statements in some of his writings about how what we need is a despotic form of government. And the fact that I bring that out in the book, and that, you know, really high-minded people are indifferent to other people's suffering as long as a greater good is being achieved. And so the thing is with oneness, Josh, you don't have to be nice. You don't have to be kind. You don't have to have the betterment of anybody in mind, because at the end of the day, if we're all one, good doesn't matter. Right or wrong doesn't matter. Your cancer, your cough, your cold, your children, your conditions, whatever, good or bad, all of it is illusionary. There is no distinction ultimately. And so you can take a position as somebody high up that, and where there's an altruistic, I believe I'm doing this for the betterment of humanity and I want to help everybody. You can take that position. Fine. I've seen people do it. Or you can take a position more like Bertrand Russell's position. Okay. The lower members of society, they suffer. So what? Who cares?
Wow.
We're working for a higher ideal.
Right. So in part two of your book, you talked about this concept of shifting faiths and the temple of man. And this kind of dovetails with some of my research into the New Age. Stephen Bancars and I wrote The Second Coming of the New Age. And there was, I've noticed in going through some of your book, there's some a little bit of overlap here. What is the temple of man and what's this concept of shifting faiths?
Shifting faith, well, first of all, part two is really an historic survey demonstrating in the first part of, or the chapter three, the first chapter in that section, that we have moved away from Christendom. And in basically that chapter, chapter three, Shifting Faiths, is a very brief overview of the Renaissance, the Reformation, the shift out of the Christian ethos, however that was constructed at that point in time. Because, of course, we're talking about an era where there's a lot of turmoil as well. The Reformation was a messy time period. And what we saw with the closure of the Reformation was the beginning of the Age of Modernity. And that's really where Chapter 4 comes into play, as we see man building a secular temple, a temple to himself, a temple through reason, a temple through materialism. The new orthodoxy would be science, it would be planning, it would be new social structures, and built around the idea that the church and Christendom were finished. We were done. We were entering a new secularist age. And you know, the person that really, really epitomized this, and there's a lot of examples in the book, and I open up chapter four with this one, was V.I. Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, the founder of the Soviet Union, and definitely the most prominent individual one of the most prominent individuals in the 20th century. I can't think of too many men who had more influence than Vladimir Lenin.
Right.
And this is what he said. And it fits perfectly as the opening quote to the Temple of Man, chapter four. Yes, we're going to destroy everything. And on the ruins, we will build our temple. And so I take you through how we were destroying the Christian ethic, the Christian social ethos, and over top of that, modernity laid a new foundation, and it was going to be a new secular age. But you know, there's always interest in spirituality, and during the era of modernity, the irony was new ideas in religion and esoteric philosophy were absolutely flowering in the 1800s, especially the last half of the 1800s. Everything from the Baha'i faith to Rosicrucianism coming about as a new organizations of Rosicrucianism, theosophy. There was just an explosion from Mormonism to the Jehovah's Witnesses, an absolute explosion of faith. Spiritism. Huge, right. Absolutely huge in that time period. And that was the height of modernity, when we would have this entering of a secularist age. And so chapter four, as we see the faith shift from the Christian ethos into one that is pragmatic, into scientific, into materialist, We really, you know, unpack what that looks like, and then how that changes the tempo of our culture. And of course, it brings you around to then the next phase of, you could call it, social development. And that was, we entered the era of postmodernity in the 1960s. And I have two chapters after that, one that deals with postmodernism and then the New Age movement. And I kind of dovetail how both of those dovetailed with each other. Postmodernism basically said, hey, Christianity, we push that aside. Modernity, hardcore materialism, no. That stripped the soul of meaning. That stripped humanity of purpose and meaning. What's left? Well, we wandered around. We wandered around in a fuzzy daze. That's what was left. And the New Age came into play. New ideas of Eastern spirituality entered into the Western mind. And so we really worked to unpack this history, because that's so important. We don't know the history. We have it in bits and pieces, but I think that section of the book does a fairly decent job. It's just a survey demonstrating how we moved away from Christianity as that foundation into, well, postmodernism. But the center of it is, Josh, I believe that postmodernism is now fading. I believe that we have a new era that's replacing postmodernism, and it's a spin-off of the New Age movement, and I think it really supersedes now even the New Age movement, and that's re-enchantment. And we really play a lot in the area of what does re-enchantment look like, which is really creating a new myth about we becoming divine, not you in the New Age movement. And you understand from your studies and your time in the New Age, it's a lot of it was about self-development. You yourself becomes divine. Whereas re-enchantment is, oh no, we're all connected into this unity of divinity. And we are doing this with we, not me, in mind.
Now that's interesting, because I think that started to take off right around the time I was getting out of New Age. So I didn't experience as much of that, but that did come up in my research as well. And my co-author, Stephen Bancars, he understood that better than I did. Because yeah, you're right. When I was in New Age movement, it was really self-centered. It was more about, we would say self-godhood. At the time, they wouldn't word it that way exactly, because they were trying to sell it. But that's what it was. It was self-godhood. But somehow that changed to this collective we kind of thing. And what I noticed when I was in New Age is that the idea of me being divine, they paint it as, you know, you're special, you're wonderful, you're special, all this stuff. But what it really is that you're superior. You know, you're not just special, you're superior to everybody else. And it gives you a lot of pride and arrogance. So that was what I was used to. And then right around the time I was getting out of it was when it was shifting to this we thing. What caused that shift? What does that look like? And where do you think that it's, where do you think that that's headed?
Well, you know, I think part of the shift came about by the thinness, to use a kind of maybe a weird term, the thinness of the New Age movement. It's a spiritual smorgasbord, but it's a very thin spiritual smorgasbord. So there was not really the depth needed to bring about, let's say, world unity or ideas of let's find a new myth that unifies humanity. The New Age couldn't really do that because it was almost like a Western marketplace of ideas that was chaos. It was whatever you gravitated to. There was nothing there that, you know, that you could really pin down and say, here's a myth that the world could follow, whether you were of the New Age or not. And so the New Age movement was very, very important. Absolutely. In fact, it still is. It's still, you know, you and I both know it still exists today. You know,
big time.
The animal may change its spots, but it's still the same animal.
That's right.
But where I really see the change beginning, you could actually say the change was beginning right when the New Age was even being birthed in the 1960s and 70s. The change was already in motion at that point, but already in the early part of the year 2000, in the late 1990s, especially with the United Nations Millennium events that took place, the Millennium Forum, the Millennium Summit, and then the Millennium Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders, that really helped to set the tone that we have to work together, that we all need to come together to save the earth. And in saving the earth, we save ourselves. In saving the planet, we save humanity. And there was this hope in the air that the Millennium Project would be the grand project of we were all going to be doing this together. I watched it. I witnessed it. I was a delegate at the United Nations Millennium Forum. And Lucis Trust was there. Groups with other theosophical leanings were there. New Age groups. And then all kinds of other organizations. Everything from, golly, the Girl Scouts. And they were there. Right up to major NGOs that deal with social change, environmental issues. A whole list of organizations. And I had embedded myself with an organization built around the idea of creating world government. And we more or less ran that event. And so at that point, there was this real anticipation that the move was away from the self and now towards the planet and now towards the we and now towards unity. Our power would be found in unity. And so I look into the year 2000 and see that as being a hallmark year that helped to kind of shift the thinking. And you could go all the way back to 1970, to the very first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. And you could also see the shift begin at that point, too. You can see the shift beginning as well with the Club of Rome in the early 1970s and also with the Stanford Research Institute in the early 1970s. I talk about both of that in Chapter 7, how both the Club of Rome and the Stanford Research Institute were looking to find a new myth for humanity, something that would bring us all together. And really, the thing that is common to all of humanity is the Earth. The Apollo program, when the astronauts looked back on the planet and saw there's our mother, there's our Earth. That the image and the metaphor of the planet as being our collective home really resonated and was big in the New Age movement, but was big in even a larger concept that we're doing this as one humanity. And so all of this comes together. It all walks hand in hand with each other, but it moves us closer and closer and closer towards almost a step back in history to the new pagan ideals, because this really becomes paganism in its classic sense. The earth is alive. The elements are alive. We're all part of the elements. We have all of a sudden a shift into what the church rejected 2,000 years ago. We're now accepting, because that's where re-enchantment ultimately takes us. It puts us in a pagan age. It takes us into the realm of classical paganism, because the new myths can only mirror the old myths. We've rejected Christianity. We've rejected modernity. We're in this vacuum of meaning. What are we going to fill it with? We're going to fill it with the old myths, and that's what we've done. Just repackaged for a more sophisticated, market-savvy culture, you know, and that's what we are, supposedly.
Right, yeah, and I mean, you could even look to Bible prophecy and see hints of a one-world religion once again repeating itself, like in the days of Nimrod. Do you see all of this paganism coming together like that in a one world religion, where it's going to be basically, well, I guess it sort of is now, you know, it's already us Christians against them, but them kind of seems loose and sort of all over the place. Do you think that bond is going to get tighter with them? And then once we get further into prophecy, it really will be like a one world religion. How do you see that playing out?
You know, I can't say, because I don't have the glasses on to foretell the future.
You don't? So, well, why did I bring you on in the first place?
but I can definitely, I mean, yes, we know biblically we are moving into some system of the world becoming the Tower of Babel again.
Right.
But what I'm seeing at this point, and that's all I can speak of, and here's the thing. Yeah. I mean, you and I both speak at prophecy conferences. Mm-hmm. Ironically, and I've had to tell other prophecy speakers, I'm not actually a prophecy theologian. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a prophecy speaker. I unpack what I'm seeing right now.
Sure.
And so here's just an example of how I'm seeing things move. At the 2015 Parliament of the World's Religions, there was a lot of talk that we are not looking for unity anymore. because in the interfaith movement, at first, it really was, we were hoping for unity. And in fact, in the year 2000, it was really, really anticipated that there would be a united religions, literally an interfaith religious body that would be equivalent to the United Nations. There was a great hope that that would be in existence. And indeed, I was at the charter signing when that organization was founded back in 2000 in Pittsburgh. But it didn't come about the way they were anticipating. It didn't happen. But the interfaith movement has often been about here. We're about unity, 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 coming together in a vague hope that we all become one, the perennial philosophy. In 2015, the language changed at the Parliament of World Religions, and it was openly acknowledged the language is changing. We are moving away from unity to harmony, and there's a difference. Mm. Unity says we're coming together as one. Harmony says we recognize all of our unique diversity and differences. We recognize those all as just the culture, the trappings, the traditions, the unique teachings, but really all of that still can harmonize under a common worldview. And that common worldview is oneness, that man, God, and nature are all intrinsically, essentially the same. And we see it playing out in this vastness of diversity. And so that was the language, that was how it was pulled together at the 2015 Parliament, moving away from unity, now bringing us into the idea of harmony. I think that that idea of harmony is probably more subtle and more powerful than the idea of unity, because unity, even people of diverse faiths will put their hands and say, hey, I am not the same. My beliefs are not the same as X or Y or Z. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you say harmony, they can go, oh yeah, I can stay within my traditions and you stay in your traditions. And we come to an agreement on something fundamental and something that we believe is common, and that's oneness. And so that was really, really interesting. And it's nuanced, but it has pretty big implications, because you don't have to have a one world religion under that kind of a concept.
That's right.
You can keep all your traditions, and yet you all bow to the same oneness.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, there's a lot of people. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. No, it is interesting because, I mean, that kind of represents almost like a new way of thinking, at least within the interfaith movement.
It kind of makes me think of a perversion of what Jesus wanted for us Christians. You know, when in scripture, it talks about Jesus praying to the Father, and what he asked for was that we would have unity with one another as brothers and sisters in Christ. And for what reason? So that the world would know who Jesus is, that the world would know that Jesus is the Savior, would know the love that God has for all of us, all those things that we keep wanting to teach the world. You know, we take on the Great Commission and we know we're supposed to do that, but along with that, Jesus lays it out in his prayer, the best way to attain that is for us to have unity. Now, does that mean that we're going to agree on every single little point of non-salvational doctrine? No, of course not. We're going to have different rapture beliefs, and we're going to have different beliefs about non-salvational things. But we're still supposed to be unified through that, and that takes humility. That takes all the stuff that we're taught about. What you're describing sort of sounds like like the enemy's version of this, like a New Age, Antichrist version of what Jesus wanted for us Christians. I mean, to me, it's almost like the enemy is saying, you know what, you know, these Christians can't even, they can't even get along with one another when they disagree on the shape of the earth. So I'm going to show how, I can get the world together despite all of their differences under this idea of a new golden age or something like that. It sounds like it's a perversion of an anti-Christian type of thing from what Jesus wanted for us Christians. Do you think there's a motivation there from the enemy?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, because this is spiritual. This really is spiritual. There's no doubt about it. This is part of that larger spiritual game, and you see the threads of that going all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. I mean, where did oneness begin? The concept of oneness. Well, it's really a Genesis chapter 3 concept. where we can be as God. There puts us into that realm. Romans chapter 1 also demonstrates that. The idea that the creation, in essence, worships itself instead of the creator.
Right.
And so, I mean, there is a common spiritual thread that goes right back to the very first lie, the lie given by an angel of light, the lie given by a deceiving spirit. And, this is just my belief. I may be wrong, but it's my belief. I believe that the last lie, the final lie, the one that brings God back down to judge the earth, will absolutely reflect the first lie. And it's just going to be lived out in its entirety. That's what it will be.
Yeah, I agree, because you look at the times where God has actually had to come down and deal with things. You got Eden, you got Babel, and then yep. You got a whole bunch of it in Revelation, but it's all that same lie. You're 100% correct. I do want to get to Q&A, but before we do, we barely scratched the surface, and I'm looking at so many things in your book that we could talk about. We dealt a little bit with the spiritual politics stuff. Maybe this, and so people at home, get your questions ready. We're going to do Q&A, and we'll do that for a little while, as long as you guys want to at home, and as long as Carl wants to. But what would you want? And again, for everybody at home, we just barely scratched the surface. What would you want people at home most to take away from Game of Gods? And I know that's a hard question, because there's so many topics that you cover and you do it so well. But is there a unifying message that you really want the church to grab hold of?
Yeah, there's a few unifying messages.
Sure.
One, and I don't say it explicitly, but I hint at it all through the book. What the world is presenting to us is an alternative version of salvation. It's easy for us to say, to chase rabbit trail memes, rabbit trail internet arguments, all kinds of stuff, and to find all kinds of cool and interesting subtopics to go and explore. Conspiracy theories that are true or untrue. We explore all kinds of stuff. But the thing I want people to realize is that ultimately, what the world is presenting in the pages as I presented in my book is an alternative salvation message, an alternative plan of redemption. And it is the plan of redemption given by man to man, given by fallen spirits to man. And it really is an alternative redemption story. That is what we try to do. When we build heaven on earth, when we attempt to do that here, we are playing God. We are now saying our redemption comes through the works of our hands. That's a really, really important part of what the book does. It breaks that down. So that now when you see it in the world around you, I don't want you to think about it in terms of, oh, it's a conspiracy theory. No, think about it far more seriously than that. It's not. It's an alternative redemption story. That's what it is. And I think it's really key. It's really key that we get our heads out of some of the the peripheral arguments that we end up having, over conspiracy theories, and recognize that, at the fundamentals, and that's what I'm working through the book, it really is an alternative redemption plan. And it's going to bring God's judgment. Our redemption plans always do, because they fail. The problem can't fix itself. That's a big one. That's a huge part of why people need to read the book, so they can unpack that and see that for themselves. There's a few takeaways in the book that I've already seen come to fruition in some interesting ways. I've had former New Agers contact me and say, your book helped me now to intellectually understand what I spiritually accepted.
Oh, wow.
That's big. That's really, really big. I've had one person come to Christ because of the writing of the book. The book wasn't even done yet, but the person was in contact with me early in the summer or middle of last summer, and working through what I was writing about, working through all kinds of stuff. And the book already was a very key part of him coming back to the Christian faith, even after his studies in the Kabbalah, studies in Buddhism, studies in Native American spirituality. So, hey, to me, honestly, Josh, that's super, super exciting, knowing that one person already, this was used to bring him back to Christ. That's just, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I remember one of the first times that happened with me in one of my videos. And yeah, you don't ever forget stuff like that. That's a big deal.
Oh, it's huge, really huge. I mean, yeah, that's really what it was about. You know, that's really what it's about in terms of reaching out to the non-Christian community. And then in my introduction, I thank my globalist, my transhumanist, and my burner friends, and my friends who are atheists, agnostics, and people from other faiths for reading this book. Here's the thing. Just before we began our conversation, I received an email from a friend who is a very well-connected globalist who is now reading my book. And when I'm saying well-connected globalist, member of the Club of Rome, deeply embedded in the upper echelons at the United Nations. He's retired now, but he is... He's working through it. Wow. through it. So I'm going, okay, there's something in this book for everybody. I've got teenagers working through it. I've got homeschoolers working through it because they see the value in the historical side that's being unpacked. There's a lot of things that I think the Christian community can pull out of it. Here's something. Yeah. This is a little bit different. I'm really hoping it raises the bar. I'm really hoping my book... And this might sound, you know, just stupid, arrogant of me. I hope it raises the bar in terms of how we do Christian research. I hope it raises the bar in terms of what we read and how we read. And I bring this out in the scope of the book. I was told so often, and it's proper, it's right in one respect. Keep the cookies on the lower shelf. I've been told that a lot. Because I don't. I kind of have a tendency to put the cookies a little bit higher than the lower shelf. And people tell me that all the time. Well, you know something? I want the cookies to be on the higher shelf. Because it's time we as Christians reach up and intellectually, theologically, and in every respect, start to stretch and push ourselves. We have been fed nothing but pablum and having the cookies on the lower shelf for so stinking long. No, it's time to reach up. It's time to grasp things of higher value and things of deeper and more complex structures so that we can understand it better and then hopefully be better ambassadors for Christ.
Amen. I am so on board with that. I actually was just having a conversation with my wife earlier today about that very thing. We were talking about, the best methods to reach Christians where they are today. And, you know, I was making the point, there's too many people in positions of, you know, authority where they'll just kind of placate to the Christian, you know, they'll placate to where they are now, and they don't teach them to try to think deeper or teach them how to even think deeper, how to hear an opposing argument without getting personally offended by it. Things like that. Because, you know, we as Christians have a lot of division. We've got a big division problem, and a lot of it is caused by little differences and non-salvational issues and little things that in the big picture of what we're living in, what we're dealing with, don't really matter that much. Right. But when your worldview is this big, that's all you can focus on. You know, when you wrap your whole worldview around one thing, whatever it is, it could be any kind of, you know, conspiracy theory or any kind of little pet theory. When you wrap your entire worldview about that one thing, and then that's what your focus is on, and you shut out anybody that has a different view about that one non-salvational thing. Yep. It's a very small way to think, but not only that, and I'm not trying to be insulting with it. This is where many Christians are, and I was for a really long time too. And that's why I'm, you know, talking about it, because I understand. I don't agree with that way of thinking, but I understand that line of thinking because I was in it for years and years and years. You're not really woken up when you're in that. Most people that are, they think that they are woken up, but you're really woken up when you realize that, you know what? The best, well, okay. One thing is, the best way that you can sharpen your own argument is to hear out opposing arguments that you disagree with. That's the best way to do it. Not only that, but once you can learn to like have love for that other person, especially if it's a Christian, we need to love everybody no matter what, because if you're going to try to evangelize somebody or get somebody saved and you don't have any love for them, it's not going to register. But, especially if it's a Christian who has a different view, and I see so much Christian on Christian hatred, especially online, it blows my mind that it's gotten that bad. But when it's a Christian, the Bible commands us to love one another. Like, we have to. It takes it so seriously. It says we cannot love God unless we love one another. It's impossible. You can't do it. So if we're not loving one another, there's no way that we can say that we have love for God. I mean, those right there are the two main commandments, but you can't have one without the other. So I love that you said that. I'm right there with you, and I totally agree that we as Christians, it's kind of time for us to grow up a little bit and get a little bit of thicker skin and start having real in-depth conversations with one another that aren't built around emotion and ad hominem stuff and straw man arguments and all this just emotional stuff. It's time if we're going to have emotion towards one another, let it be love, and then let the rest of it be intellectual conversations and stuff like that. I do want to give a very special thank you to Barbara Briggs. She is one of our moderators. I also want to thank Harmony, our other moderator. Barbara Briggs gave a very generous $5 donation, said, "Hi, Carl and Josh, just wanted to send love and encouragement. Love your book, Carl." That is so sweet, Barbara. Thank you. And everybody in the chat, give a big thanks to Barbara and Harmony for being the best moderators out there and keeping the trolls out of our awesome conversation here. And if you have a question for Carl, now is the time. Put it in the chat. I will be scrolling through while we talk to find any questions that you have. It is Q&A, official Q&A time. Put your questions in the chat and let's see if you have a question for Carl or myself, I guess. But really, you should ask Carl something, because it's not every week that we can have Carl on. While they're getting that together, do you want to tell us one more time where they can find out more about you, where they can order your book?
Sure. They can go to gameofgods.ca. And one thing you can do at Game of Gods is you can check out the excerpts. I put the first few pages of every chapter on that webpage, so you can go and read snippets all the way through from the beginning of the book to the ending of the book. And then you can order it on Amazon. And I would encourage people to do that, not simply because I'm hoping that book sell, and I am hoping the book sells. I mean, you're an author. You want to see that happen. But I really hope that the book will be of value, and I mean a real value in terms of helping people understand the world around us. And then second, and probably this is a huge part of it, so we can be better ambassadors for Christ.
Yeah, amen. That is what it is all about, and I'm totally on board with that. So people, put your questions in. One person is asking, where is Jasmine the cat? I have two cats, Jasper and Jasmine. Jasmine is her own person. I don't know where she is. She will not come to my calls. Even if I called her, she would run in the other direction. But the time I don't want to see Jasmine, that is the time she'll be on my lap. So I'm actually surprised that she's not here right now, because she loves interrupting the show, and it is really sweet. So here's a question for you. Now, there's this kind of tracks along with what you were talking about before, about how we as Christians sometimes can tend to focus on these little niche conspiracy things. So with your research into these secret societies, any of them, Rosicrucians, Freemasons, How much of what we typically believe about them is actually true? Because I wonder, I sometimes wonder if we're giving them too much credit, if we think they're more powerful than what they really are, if they're really pulling the strings as much as we think they are. What has your research brought up about that? And how does that either compare or contrast with just common conceptions, especially within like our fringe Christian, circles and all that, what we think about these secret societies?
Well, I think it depends what historic time frame you're talking about.
Let's say today.
Let's say today. Well, I'm gonna couch the historic time frame, and because it's an important part of this.
Yeah, definitely.
My little town that I grew up in, or grew up beside, the town's called Gladstone. I live in the Canadian prairies. Gladstone was the oldest incorporated town west of Winnipeg, Manitoba. So it's got a little bit of a history. And the Masonic Lodge had always been there. In fact, the lodge, from what I understand, was incorporated before the town was incorporated, when it was just simply a little hamlet of sorts. And really, all the way through the 20th century, my town was a Masonic town. I mean, if you were anybody in business, you joined the lodge. If you were on council, town council, you were part of the lodge. If you were a mayor, you typically had a connection into the lodge. I mean, the lodge, in many respects, ran the town. And there were some pretty interesting things, some pretty hairy things that happened. And it really did. It really had an incredible impact on our community, both for good and also some pretty negative things too. But they're gone. Demographically, they died out. Oh, now wow. the lodge has been gone now for probably 15 years, maybe even longer. Demographically, it waned. And Freemasonry has been in a demographic downfall for a long, long time. Back in the year 2000, I went to the House of the Temple, and I did it in a little different way. I was going to a World Federalist meeting, talking on world government, and I figured I'm going to go to the House of the Temple too. So I took along with me a bunch of Rosicrucian manuals and got to the door, because I didn't know how to do this. I didn't know what I was doing. And I figured this might be the way to kind of open the door. Got to the House of the Temple. The door opened. I showed them my briefcase. I showed them that I had Rosicrucian documents and said, hey, I'm a student of the mysteries. Because, yeah, I'm a researcher. That's what I do then. You know,
You
can play that game. So I played that game. I said, I'm a student of the mysteries, and showed them some of the stuff I was working through. And they opened up the door and said, welcome home. And then they gave me this incredible one-on-one tour that lasted 3 hours. And the fellow was talking all about how Freemasonry had so much clout in Washington, D.C. And it did, and it probably still does. And what struck me is we went into J. Edgar Hoover's office, which is located in the House of the Temple. And he was describing to me the battle that took place between the FBI and Freemasonry over who was going to control J. Edgar Hoover's personal FBI belongings after he passed. And he smiled and looked at me and said, we won. And I went, oh, there's some clout. There's some serious clout. And so, I mean, yeah, in some respects, there's a lot of clout. The secret societies have had a role. And I think really the real importance of that role was not what strings they pulled politically, because they have. And sometimes they didn't pull the strings you think they did either. History has a way of being far more complex and far more nuanced than we understand.
Yeah.
But I think really where the role was is it helped shape people's worldviews. And especially when it comes to the idea of things like religious universalism, working out our own salvation, the idea that through our unity, we construct the temple of man. I think really those fundamental worldview issues are the legacy that they've left us that is of far more importance than did they assassinate this, or did they, you know, go over here and do that. Some of it maybe they did, some of it maybe they didn't. We don't know. Some of this is lost in history. It's really, history is far more complicated than people realize. We like to say they did it. And sometimes they did. And a lot of times we don't know, but it makes a great story. Let's actually unpack the worldview that's being presented, because I think that has had far greater effect on our culture than any political conspiracies or behind the scenes dealings that were done by members of certain secret societies.
Oh, big time. And I mean that, you know, if you're trying to influence the way the world goes, you would go after the culture. Who was it? Andrew Breitbart is famous for saying that politics is downstream of culture. You control the culture, and then the politics will follow. Joseph Franklin, thank you for your super chat donation of $5. He actually has a good question that sort of ties in with this. How far does the deception of New Age reach inside the body of Christ? What is, if any, is the most common theme in your book, pun intended? What is your research brought up about the New Age in the church? Do you see how far reaching is it?
Well, first of all, I didn't address it in the book per se. It's there, but not with a lot of depth. I deal with it more from its own perspective. But yeah, in terms of the New Age in the church, oh golly, we have become a New Age. We have a New Age church culture. This is one of the questions I'm bringing up in the book: is what is true spirituality in terms of Christian worship? Is it a feeling? Where do we receive our knowledge of who God is? Is it from our personal experiences? When it comes to things like contemplative practices, the church is rife with contemplative practices. The church is loaded with examples of neo-Gnosticism, where it's about my higher potential. Oh golly, I did a labyrinth walk in church. I didn't quite feel the centering effect I thought it would feel by discovering God in the center of the labyrinth. There's labyrinths in churches all across North America. Well, okay, you didn't feel that. Come back next week and we'll give you, you know, Jesus calling or something else, and go home and do a bunch of meditation and think about this, and maybe your inner voice will, you know, on and on and on. Sorry, this is Gnosticism. This is Gnosticism in the church. And we are loaded with it, absolutely stinking loaded with it. That and human potential. I trace the history of the human potential movement going back to Esalen in the early 1960s and the importance of the Esalen Institute. That's one of the surprises I received in unpacking this, because I kept running into Esalen over and over and over and over again. And I had already done some knowledge, some work on it. I knew about it. But as you sometimes work, and you know this as an author, going through something more than normal, all of a sudden you realize, wow, there are threads here that go deeper than what I even imagined. Esalen was one of those surprises. And Esalen really birthed the human potential movement. It really opened up the West to the Eastern worldview. And it acted as a springboard for liberal theology, connecting that with the Eastern concept and connecting that with human potential, bringing about a whole new marketability of spirituality in the church that is really an alternative spirituality. Hey, you know something? My relationship with God doesn't depend on how I feel.
That's right.
He stays the same. Right. I may have really, really bad days, but it doesn't change his love to me. It doesn't change his forgiveness. It doesn't change the assurance. I may have just a completely sucky day, or I may absolutely this might be just fantastic, but it doesn't change who he is, and it doesn't change that relationship he has.
That's such a good point to bring up. And, you know, there's a lot about having kids that, you know, I think that's like God's tool, you know, just the fact that we have kids and all that. I think that's God's tool of teaching us some shadows of his relationship with us. Obviously, his relationship with us is far more in depth, and it goes beyond what we can understand. But, you know, you think about your child. When my child has a bad day and just doesn't feel like talking or something, it doesn't change my relationship with, you know, with any of my kids. I still, like, my daughter will have moody days like that sometimes. I have moody days like that sometimes. But, you know, it doesn't change our actual relationship at all. There's no, actually, if anything, if we're willing to, you know, just kind of get through it and then talk about it later, it can deepen the relationship, because we're honest with one another. We're vulnerable with one another. That's what building a relationship is all about. And but yeah, I mean, I I'm so on board with that. there's a lot that you've been saying tonight that's tracking a lot with what I've been thinking about lately. And God has shown me so much about just how his relationship with us and our relationship with him. I really, really believe that God gave us children as a blessing so we can understand, not only for that, but a part of it is so we can understand what his relationship with us and ours with him is sort of like. Because just like you said, my daughter has just some sucky days sometimes, and I have some sucky days sometimes, but it doesn't change the overall, tone or aspect of our relationship. If anything, it has the potential to deepen it, because I learned more about myself through those times. And now I've kind of learned to apply that through that understanding. I've learned to start to apply that with my relationship with God. There are times where, you know, I'm just, I don't feel as close or as into it, or, you know, whatever. I don't know what the word is exactly, but there are days where you're just really on fire for the Lord. And then there are days where it's just kind of, I just want to watch Netflix all day and not think about anything. You know, sometimes you have those days, but it doesn't change the overall tone of the relationship you have with the Lord. If anything, it can strengthen it, because when you have those days, and then when you get through it, you can reflect back, talk to God about it, and ask him, hey, what was my deal that day? You know, and I mean, he'll show you, and he'll show it you in a loving way. And it's wonderful. So those can be, and it's the same with my daughter. There are times where she'll have a bad day, and then we'll talk about it the next day. There are times I have a bad day, we talk about it the next day. So that's awesome. I'm on board with that. WAR is asking, he's directing it to me. I'll do a real quick, real short version of this, and then I'll turn you loose on it. But he's saying, at Josh, why is it that the church has such a terrible record of offering restoration to people? I would say you have two people, and you have two types of people in the church that I know of. I mean, you got a lot of different kinds, but you can kind of break them down into two groups. You got the kind that's like mainstream Christianity, who they don't even know that they're supposed to try to preach restoration, preach repentance, preach, you know, turning away from sin. That's mainstream Christianity, because there are a lot of mega pastors today who don't teach that stuff. But then you have kind of like where I would fall in, like more of the fringe Christians. And a lot of us, like our problem is sometimes kind of what we were talking about today. Sometimes we focus too much on, you know, the fringe aspects of our Christianity, because we were never fed it in church. We were never taught about, you know, Nephilim or whatever it might be, any number of things. We were never taught about that in church. So then when we get in and we find this group, then we become almost too obsessed with it. And then we kind of forget about the restoration part of it. And then I would say a third thing, and that's that, just real quickly, we're not the one that offers restoration. That's for the Lord Jesus Christ to do. We're our role in this whole thing is to present people with this option, because most people don't even know that this is an option, that most people don't really know who Jesus is or what his role in their lives is. You know, I'm talking about non-Christians here. So when we go and preach the good news, we're not the ones that offer restoration. We tell people how Jesus can offer restoration to them. And the only way that we can do that, you know, we should do it in a personal way, because that's how God handles us. So we get to know them. We, you know, get to know what their needs are. We talk to them one-on-one. You know, there's several ways to go about that. But as long as we keep in mind that we are not the ones that offer restoration, that is Jesus' job. And then you know, as the kids would say in my day, they probably don't say it anymore, as the 35-year-old millennials would say now, as long as we know how to own our role, you know, we had to do it. It's cringe. But as long as we know what our role in this process is and what Jesus' role is, he's the one that offers all of that. We just present people with the information of what Jesus already did. But we have to understand that information really intimately, because they're going to have a lot of questions, as well they should. Many of us had questions before we became Christians too. So they should have questions. We need to know how to answer that. So that's, believe it or not, that was brief. That's the brief answer. What do you think, Carl? Why is it that the church has such a terrible record of offering restoration to people?
I think you covered it. I really think you covered it in many respects, Josh. You thought this thing through, and you're right. You said something that kind of clicked with me. The world, the non-Christian world, they don't understand who Jesus is.
That's right.
They don't get it. They don't understand it. Here's the thing. They think they know. They think they know who they've rejected. They think they know what they've rejected. And this is a lesson I took back with me when I after going to Burning Man the first time, because we talked to so many people at the burn when we set up our sign, Camp of the Unknown God, and that became an Act 17 model.
I think that's so cool that you guys did that. That's an amazing thing. You got to tell that story. Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
but you know, Josh, that was a test. When we did it, when Robert Worley and I did it in 2017, that was a test. If we are living in an enchanted, paganized culture, whether people know it, recognize it, or not, if we are living in that, then there has to be a biblical response, a biblical model. And the Acts 17 model is really it. It's Paul going to a completely pagan society, finding the leverage points, and in that case, a monument to the unknown God, and then using that to launch into the message of Jesus Christ, the character of God, the nature of man, and Jesus Christ resurrected. And so we basically said, okay, let's try that at Burning Man. And really right up to the first week before the week before the 2017 burn, we weren't really sure how we were going to do it. And it was a lady in my church who came to me and she said, you guys need a sign. And she knew the approach we wanted to take, but we didn't have that visual. We didn't have the provocative lever to open up the conversation when we were there. And she says, you need a sign. And the sign should say, Camp of the Unknown God. Wow. Does that open conversations? Oodles and oodles of conversations. 2017, 2018, both years we have done this. And my goodness, I have never seen and never have been a part of so many conversations in the course of a week on talking about Christianity, talking about Jesus Christ, talking about what is true spirituality versus false spirituality. And the thing that I walked away from in the 2017 burn was this. We have a culture that has rejected Jesus, and now they don't even know who they've rejected, why they've rejected, or what they've rejected. They've just rejected. They've rejected a caricature of Christianity, and it's a culturally generated caricature. They've rejected a culturally generated caricature of what the Christian life is all about. And you know something? I reject those too, because it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Let's get back to the source of Christianity, which is God's word, not what the culture says about Christianity. Let's get back to the source. Let's go back to God's word. And the Burning Man experience in both cases demonstrated to me that we have a culture that at this point hasn't really a clue about Christianity. They've rejected it, but they really don't know what they've rejected. That's an open door. That is an open door. If we handle it properly, that's an open door to bring about the true Jesus Christ.
I just love your attitude about that. That's great. That's exactly how I feel about it too. Even though a lot of these people have made up their minds, they supposedly rejected, there's still room because, like you said, they don't really know what they're rejecting. And I think that's so profound for us because then we can go in and tell them and try to convince them and change their mind. But the only way that we're going to do that is if we know what we're talking about, which goes back to your point earlier, that we need to think higher about this stuff more intelligently. We can't be emotion driven. And that was a point I made. We can't just let these little differences that we find amongst each other define our relationships with one another. That's such a big mistake. That's what the world does. Just look at leftist American politics. That is what the left, that is what the world does. Why should we want anything to do with that? Look what it's doing to them. And not turning it into a political thing, but look what it's doing to them. They're having to eat their own now because they've destroyed themselves so bad, and they're so illegitimized in the eyes of the country that you just see that time and time again. We'll do one more question, then let's wrap it up. This is an easy. Well, maybe it's not. It's a short one. We'll say that. This one was also directed at me, but I'm actually curious to know what Carl says about this too. So Vicky Taylor is asking, does anyone know what denomination Josh is? And again, I'll try to keep it brief. So I was raised Baptist, and then I had too many questions that weren't being answered. So, and I'm not saying all Baptists are like that, but at least in my church, it was like KJV only, really legalistic, and anything supernatural, they didn't really want to talk about. So then I flung just out of Christianity and into New Age. And then after that, when I was coming back into Christianity, I was kind of in the charismatic stuff for a little while. And then I really cycled through a lot of different denominations just trying to find my place. And for me, I found out, you know what? I think I'm just non-denominational. I don't think that I really fit in. And it's not this typical, like, you know, a millennial thing that you'll hear of, well, I don't believe in labels. I think labels are just fine. You know, I think that's fine. There are wonderful Baptists, wonderful charismatics, wonderful Pentecostals, wonderful Lutherans. I mean, they're wonderful Catholics. I know that's a controversial thing to say, but as long as somebody believes that Jesus Christ is their savior, hey, the rest of it is details. And then we can talk about that and have good conversation. So I don't mind the differences, and I don't even mind the labels, but for me, there's just too much I don't know. I personally can't lock myself into any one denomination. So technically, I mean, I say non-denominational, even though non-denominational has kind of become its own denomination. I just sort of do my own thing, and that's about it. What about you, Carl? What denomination are you?
Well, you know, I'm not really a denomination. I grew up in an evangelical Mennonite church, and that's the church I went to as a baby, literally in my mother's arms, and is a church I still attend. I've been a part of that church now coming on 51 years of my life. By saying evangelical, non-denominational Mennonite, we were part of a larger Mennonite group at one point. Broke away in the early 70s because we saw the handwriting on the wall with the higher organization around us and said, okay, it's time to step away and pursue biblical truth without necessarily some of these problems and trappings. And then in the early 1990s, we took the name Mennonite off our church because even though we are of that Mennonite background, we're not followers of Menno Simons, flat out. We're not followers of Menno Simons. We're followers of Jesus Christ. And we're actually not even pacifistic as a church. We have some pacifists, but we have a lot of people who aren't, myself as well. And we realize, you know, something we just don't, we're not. We're not truly Mennonites. We're not culturally understood to be Mennonites. We are first and foremost believers in Jesus Christ. And we have that Mennonite ethnic background that forms the heritage that we were born into. And so that's still the church I attend. I've been there for 51 years. That's crazy if I think about it.
That's wow. Awesome. Yeah, I mean, if I were to actually, people are often surprised when they find out I don't go to church, and it's not that it's not that I'm refusing to go. You know, I'm fine with going. It's that I live in a small town and I work in full time ministry, so basically every day has kind of been like you know, fellowship in church and all that. And so my kids get a great dose of that, as do I and my wife. But you know, I've often wondered that if I were to go back to church, if I were to start going to a church, which church would I go to? Well, in my small town, there's only one option. There's a Baptist church, but that's probably the one that I would be most comfortable in, just because that's what I grew up in. I can't really see going back to a charismatic church. Not that I have anything against them. A lot of them are wonderful people, but they're, you know, to me, there's too much of a difference. But you know what? What's funny is my wife, she grew up Messianic Jew and then charismatic. So she's on like the other end of the aisle than I have been. And I think God did that by design, because for one thing, he has an awesome sense of humor. The Lord is hilarious. But also, we have learned so much from our different backgrounds. Like when we first started dating, we would get into these really heated debates. And that was back when I didn't really know how to think about these things. That was back when I thought, well, if you're not a pre-trib rapture believer, then you're not really a Christian. I actually did used to think that. I don't think that anymore, but I did used to think that. And so we would have these heated debates about things. And through that, I kind of learned, you know what? Like Christina has always been like a stronger, I don't know if stronger Christian, stronger faith. She's had more of a spiritual backbone than I have, you know, for much of our dating and dating years and then early marriage years. And she's helped me kind of get that spiritual backbone that, you know what, it is okay to talk about this stuff. It is okay to not be emotional and be, you know, an emotional train wreck when somebody believes something you don't believe. What's really important is, why do you believe what you believe? Do you know the answer to that? And for me, I had to face the fact that a lot of what I believed was because I was raised in it and nothing more. That was it. Now, you know, and just for people who might wonder where I stand on the rapture, I stand on the rapture the way I stand with denominations. I don't know. I hope that it's pre-trib. I pray that's correct. But I think it's probably best if we just prepare that it's like post-trib. And well, what's the worst that's going to happen? Okay, it's pre-trib. We go up to heaven and God's like, man, you did way too much preparing. I just don't see God saying that. You know what I mean? But if we don't prepare, and then if it is post-trib and we don't prepare, I could see God saying, you probably should have prepared. I've said a lot about that in that Bible that you have in your house. You know, so I kind of look at it. And I've learned to kind of see a lot of stuff like that, especially having to do with end times prophecy, because like you said, Carl, you said so well, we don't know the unknown. We can't really see into the future. We don't own a pair of glasses that shows us exactly what the future is like. So we got to have some humility, and prophecy can just be a fun conversation. We don't have to lock into one exact thing. We can consider a lot of different options and see how they line up with scripture and try to construct the best arguments we can for what we might believe, but then just see how things play out.
You know, in terms of prophecy, some of my favorite topics of prophecy teaching is the prophecies in the Old Testament about Jesus Christ.
Oh, mine too. And what I love about it is they didn't see it coming. And I think it's going to be the same for us.
It's awesome. It's awesome. I'm going to kind of dovetail off what you just said. Cause I've had similar conversations with people. Bottom line, I can't guarantee my breath tomorrow morning.
That's right.
I don't know what's going to happen. My brother was killed when he was 17. I talk about that in the center part of my book and just how devastating that was. But at the same time, how it reinforced the truth that every breath we have is really a gift of God.
Yeah.
And that I should prepare, my heart should be prepared for his coming or my going. Because I guarantee my going is, so far there's 100% success rate in people going.
That's right. Amen.
You know, but if my heart is there for his coming or my going, then what is there to fear?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And along those lines with prophecy, every generation since Paul has thought that they were going to be the last generation, and that also has a 100% failure rate, you know? So why should we be any different, you know? And maybe we are different, you know? But I think that prophecy is left ambiguous for a reason. I think every generation since Christ, I think we need to think that we're the last ones, or at least we need to act as if we are. There's a valuable lesson in that, and it's exactly what you just said. We're not guaranteed another breath on this earth, so we need to always be prepared. And that is the message that's talked about so much in Scripture when it comes to prophecy and things, that Jesus is always about preparedness. Be prepared. You don't know when he's coming back. He didn't tell us exactly when he's coming back, but even more than that, we don't know when we're going to pass on from this earth. No one likes to think about it, but I think we kind of got to just get used to thinking about that, because it's going to happen, and we need to be prepared for that. Carl, this has been such an amazing conversation. I love you to death, brother. One more time, where can people pick up your book, and where can they find you online?
GameOfGods.ca is my website, or actually the book's website, and you can get some snippets and some information on the book there, and then you can order it through Amazon, and you can do that by clicking on GameOfGods.ca.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been an absolute blast. We're going to have you on back back on again sometime.
Josh, this was really enjoyable. Thanks for taking the time to do this with me this evening.
Absolutely. Anytime. You're one of my favorite people to talk to, and I do not say that to just anybody. Go back in the archives, watch all my videos, and you'll find out every single one. I have over 1,000 now, so it shouldn't take you very long. All right, and a big thank you to all of you at home that have been watching and joining with us. This has been a blast. Glad to have you all. Tomorrow is Ryan Peterson, Judgment of the Nephilim. I'm sure that's going to be a great conversation, so stay tuned for that. And Carl, hang on the line. I'll close this out here. And, yeah, just keep checking back. Please subscribe to this channel, everybody, and click the bell for notifications. YouTube still probably won't notify you. If they don't, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Just check back on this channel every day. You're always going to get several uploads. We upload, I think, about 8 times a day now on this channel. So you're always going to get some new, fresh material. And keep checking back at joshpeckdisclosure.com. Also, if you haven't heard, there is a podcast. Everything that we put on this channel, we make MP3s of, and we put on our podcast. You can also find that at joshpeckdisclosure.com. You'll get things as short as 10 minutes and all other things as long as 5 hours. So whatever you're looking for, you will find it there. joshpeckdisclosure.com. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to talking to you tomorrow. Ryan Peterson tomorrow, Judgment of the Nephilim. Have a great night. Love you all. Take care, and God bless.